Welcome to the Android Police podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, we are reviewing the Pixel 8a. We are talking all about Sonos's new, quite pricey, but very impressive, Ace headphones, and Microsoft and Qualcomm and all the partner OEMs had just a big, sweaty party to celebrate the Snapdragon X Elite and X Plus launch and all of the ARM-based laptops that are coming later this year. And I have feelings on it, and I think Will does as well. So we'll talk about that a little bit. And then finally, Google's dying, and it's of its own accord, it feels like, at least Google searches. And this has been a bad week for AI overviews. And well, AI in general, has had a rough week. Scarlett Johansson would probably agree. So we'll discuss that a little bit at the end. Will, you survived I.O. barely.
Yeah.
You got home after what seemed like a week.
I did, yeah. When we recorded, first of all, I'm sick. Sorry about my voice. That's like the epilogue to that story. But yeah, when I recorded with Joe Maring of Digital Trends last week, I was still in a Dallas hotel room. So just to be clear, I did make it back to my house.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, that's the like kind of happy ending story. And then I got sick, naturally.
I mean, it's what happens when you travel, but it just feels kind of unfair to end that already very stressful trip.
Yeah, real cherry on top moment, I think.
So last week you didn't talk about the Pixel 8a, which you were still reviewing at the time.
My review was out, actually. We just saved it. I wanted to save it for you. I know how how excited you are about the Pixel 8a.
Well, I mean, I didn't know the timeline because I saw you wrote kind of a hands-on with it, and then you published your review a couple days later.
Yeah.
And I.O. was just filled with other stuff. And I mean, what I'd say about I.O. is that I watched the keynote. I saw all of the sort of consumer announcements, the developer announcements. I think the fact that Google counted the number of times it said AI in the keynote is the company sort of understanding that it's a little excessive at this point, even by its own standards. And I hope that it understands that over the next year or so, we need to focus on other things because AI is not it.
It's, if anything, this week has proven that AI is not it.
And it's not even that it's underwhelming in like a substantive, it's not doing the things that it's promising. And I have separate thoughts about like hardware startups in general are having a moment again.
Yeah.
And I think it all is part of the same narrative, like this post-smartphone hardware lull that we're in, where companies, large and small, are looking desperately for something to talk about. And yesterday, this Daylight tablet launched, and it kind of sold out in a second, and it's this weird, like, healthy tablet that doesn't produce any blue light. And it got me thinking all about how the last 6 months in CES, since the Rabbit keynote and the release of the AI pin from Humane, which we'll talk about a bit later, and all of these other smaller companies are trying to do new things, and I love that. And then on the other side of the spectrum, there's Google and Microsoft, and next week Apple and OpenAI and NVIDIA, all basically refactoring their entire businesses around AI. And it's so terrifying that they've already decided the future of Silicon Valley and the future of how we are going to use their products, even though it feels like most consumers don't want that yet, or don't want it at all. So anyway, that's the preamble to talking about this Pixel 8a.
Let's hold off 1 second on the phone, because I have thoughts on this. I was thinking about this yesterday, and it's maybe something I want to write a piece about. I don't know if I have grounding in it. I think this week really cemented that I am prepared to say that AI is closer to the metaverse than not at this point. Before the last couple of weeks, you could look at Microsoft and Google and be like, they are fully committed to this in a way that could bring about interesting results. And then Google and Microsoft both held their dev conferences and showed what they had, right? Like, here's what we have. We have AI overview and Project Astra, and Microsoft has Recall, which is one of the most insane. I have so many thoughts about Recall. They're all bad. And I am ready to say that these pivots feel more like Facebook pivoting to becoming Meta and focusing on the metaverse than not, which is to say, I think in 2 or 3 years, both of these companies, or really any like legacy company that is pivoting hard to AI, will have pulled back somewhat, right? Like, they will not be out of the game, but you will start to see a refocus on non-AI. Like, IO 2027 will have an AI section that is 30 minutes, but it's not 2 hours. You know what I mean?
Right. But the question is, like, what's going to replace it?
I don't know. I think genuinely, like, the other problem, and this is kind of what I want to write about because I was thinking about this, Google is like a very reactive company in a way I don't think we talk about a lot. I think someone made a comparison on Twitter that had me thinking about this, about how a lot of Google's big initiatives are just reactions to new trends, right? So like Google Plus, that was a huge pivot for Google. Like, they really wanted that to be a success because they were scared of Facebook, and that went nowhere. This pivot to AI is at least in part, we knew they were working on this, but it is at least in part, like, every step of the way over the last almost 2 years has been a reaction to OpenAI and what they're announcing.
So I disagree with you.
Yeah.
Because I attended I.O. from 2012 through 2019.
Yeah.
So 7 years in a row. They started talking about AI substantively in 2018.
Yes, right? They did. Like,
they spent a ton of time talking about AI in 2018 and 2019. I do agree with you that there's a reactive element to the consumer side of it, right?
AI
has become a consumer product, whereas back in 2018, it was not. It was a theoretical idea. The LLM was still kind of coming into our collective consciousness as an idea, and they were talking more about theory and the ethics of AI. Whereas since ChatGPT, it's now, okay, we have to talk about the actual ways that these LLMs
and also,
can be integrated into products so that we can make money from them.
I think we're kind of saying the same thing, because as I said, Google was talking about AI before. I think the second ChatGPT 3, I guess, comes onto the scene, right? Like, is that what, October 2012? Or 2022. Oh my God. right? Like almost two years ago, Google starts talking about AI in a completely different way from that moment onwards. And I think shipping AI products in a different way, right? Like, before that, there was a much larger focus on using the term machine learning. I think they rolled out features in a way that made sense, and that consumers were mostly happy with, right? Like, I think you think about the first time they showed Magic Eraser, and I think a lot of people saw potential in that tool in a way that people walked away from I.O. last week being like, maybe I could fit some of this into my life, I guess. Like, it whenever it ships, if it lives up to the promise Google has said. Like, I think they've gone from being like, we will take this slow and build AI or machine learning or however you want to say it into our products in a way that makes sense when it's ready, to we need to do all of this now because of OpenAI.
I think you're right. And I think if OpenAI had not launched ChatGPT when it did, Google I.O. 2024 would be a different kind of presentation, because Google as a company has a tendency to be more conservative.
Right, exactly.
Than a lot of its competition. And I think we saw that with Bard, right? Bard was an unfinished front end. The name has disappeared already. Like, whether or not Gemini was the final endpoint and they just had to release Bard because Google needed to show something. And I think it's pretty clear that in retrospect, that's part of what happened.
I mean, I rewatched the 2023 I.O. a couple weeks ago, and they there is a point where they're like, yeah, and like later this year, like Bard will be powered by our new Gemini LLM. Like the tease is there if you look, once you know, right? Like even if maybe they didn't know the rebrand was going to, I don't know. But like the stars were there. You could see it. So
Google's not great with branding, but even Google knew from day one that Bard was a bad name for a product.
Yeah.
And they had Gemini in the works, right? They combined DeepMind and Google AI. Yes. And it's very clear that like Gemini was the thing that they were working on for a long time, right? The Palm and Palm 2 and all of those kind of smaller models, they weren't multimodal. They were much more constrained.
Right.
And it's very clear that like Gemini in its many, many iterations, because now there's like, what, four
versions of Gemini? Well, as you said, they're bad at branding, so.
With Flash? Yeah. What's this new one that they called? Gemini Flash?
Gemini 1.5 Flash. Come on, Daniel, get this right. It's easy.
Hey, I'm the one who got all of the references to Gemini correct a few episodes ago.
Yeah, you did. That's true.
I'm pretty proud of myself. I didn't even have any reference material, so you got to excuse me on this one. The fact that the I.O. keynote spent basically the entire time, even when they mentioned Android or any of their other products, it was still in relation to AI. This is their developer conference, right? In the past, they were like, we're going to allow you to build for our platforms, right? Whether it's the web, whether it's Android, whether it's Chrome OS, these are tangible developer platforms that you could put a thing on and you can make money by selling it as a product, right? As an app or whatever, or put ads on it or however, right? Distribute it through the Chrome App Store, through Android, through the web. We're going to help you do it all. Now they're appealing to developers. They're like, here, maybe make an agent, but like, we don't know if you're actually going to be able to sell it yet. It's just all pie in the sky stuff. And it really does feel like Google is trying to control tip to tail. The whole narrative, even for developers, is like, we're going to give you a little bit to work with here, but not enough to really make you excited about a brand new revenue stream. And we're going to relegate all the stuff that you actually make money on, the App Store, the web, etc., to day two, which is really the second division now, right? You don't really hear about what happens on day two. It's not even broadcast that widely.
No, it's not. They put it up like Thursday morning. So,
and it does feel a little bit like they're showing off and they don't really have a lot to show developers, right? The Google I.O. keynote was always about developers, but it's not anymore. It didn't feel like it anymore to me this last year and this year. It really just felt like are the things that Google is doing for Google. It's not even like Google's customers. It's like Google itself.
No, I said this, and this is not even a unique take, like this was held by other people, but, and I said it last week with Joe, but like that conference was for shareholders. It was to prove to shareholders that they are keeping up with OpenAI's progress and Microsoft's progress with OpenAI in this front. And like, you look at the stock price of Alphabet and you're like, yeah, seemed like the shareholders enjoyed the 2 hours of AI talk. Although I believe it was dipping, might have dipped yesterday. But like largely speaking, like it's gone up over the last 2 weeks. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? That's what they were hoping for. So no, it's it dipped a little bit yesterday. But
that's
but
really
like
cynical. And it, also
it is cynical, but
true.
Yeah, it's like you look at it and it's like it closed Friday, May 10th at $170, and it closed Friday, May 17th at $177. It just went up. It didn't go up, it didn't shoot up, but it rose steadily through the week. So they liked what they saw.
We have to stop being so pessimistic, Will. We're a famously pessimistic podcast.
No, you can't. No, we have to. Jules, edit that out. You can't say that. We can't do that.
Absolutely we can. What are you talking about?
No, we can't make a reference to that.
Oh my God.
Jules, edit that out.
Don't edit it out. Fine, edit it out. Whatever. Okay. Let's talk about the 8A. So in reference to all of this, right, Google can no longer just sell a $500 smartphone on its own volition. It's an AI smartphone. Everything that Google Pixel releases now will be AI first.
Right.
And then, right, this is a phone that you love, and yet you can't necessarily recommend it. You wrote two articles.
Yes.
The Pixel 8a might be my favorite Google phone yet, but I'm still not sure I can recommend it. And then followed that up with a review, a great phone that I'm not sure you should buy.
Yeah, I mean, oh, yeah. So I used that impressions piece as kind of a place to reinvestigate my feelings on the stability of Pixel software in general, and how 3 years into Tensor, we're still not at a place where, like, I can promise that you will have a stable, mostly bug-free experience. And that's not to say that any other device has a stable bug-free experience. It's just that I do feel you will find bugs that, like, ruin your daily experience, as opposed to, like, smaller stuff where you're like, weird that that app crashed. I don't know. And then, like, a couple weeks later, it gets fixed with a patch or whatever. Like, it's stuff where, like, the display is glitching out. You can't access the home screen. You know, your battery is draining at, like, 20% an hour, stuff like that, right? Like, this has happened since the Pixel 6 up through the Pixel 8. It's not consistent. And sometimes it's inconsistent between units, which is the problem. So, like, I can have a great time with the Pixel 8a. I can't promise you, the listener, will. I can't promise you, Daniel, will. Like, until I see a launch that is more in line with the experience Samsung and Apple and even, like, Motorola bring to their customers, where it's like bugs but not life-ending bugs, bugs but not things that, like, really ruin your experience with the phone that make it unusable, it is tricky to recommend, right? And with the 8a, it's double that, where it's also like, at $500, do you go up to the Pixel 8a? Do you wait for the 8 to go on sale at $550 again and spend that extra $50 on, like, a slightly nicer piece of hardware? There's a lot of questions about this phone. I don't even think Google is particularly excited about this one. Just, like, the way they launched it screams to me big Pixel 5a energy of, like, just get it on store shelves. Like, people will buy it or they won't. Who cares? Which is a shame, because, like, overall, I think it's a really nice phone.
I don't think,
like,
you can say it's Pixel 5a energy, since the 5a didn't sell outside of three countries.
Well, but, like, the 5a, like... What I mean is that, like, it's launched with the same level of fanfare. Yes, this is in many more countries, but, like, otherwise it was like, yeah, put a press release out. It's fine. It'll be on store shelves next week.
Okay, fair enough. But I also think smartphones in general are just more difficult to get people excited about.
Sure.
Like, straight up, it's a different time.
If only these companies were the ones in charge of making smartphones.
I don't think that's fair. I think it's just harder.
It is harder. Right? I just, like, it is. I just, and there's no...
I have an anecdote that I can use as a parallel here. I was away last weekend at a wedding. Congratulations, Chris and Shara. I don't think you listened to this, but just in case. And my brother texts me, because he's at home with my kids, and my mom was here as well. They were babysitting. They're watching the golf on Sunday afternoon, and my LG B7 OLED from 2017 just shuts off, straight up, just shuts down. Apparently the power supply blew or something happened. It beeped a couple times, no longer gets any power. Like, shit. All right. So I get home, I investigate, I try to plug it into other things. Doesn't work. I'm like, all right, it's dead. I'm going to buy a new TV. I can choose to repair it, or I can buy a new one, right? The repairing an OLED, I called around, it's about $500-$600, a brand new, or not brand new, but like a brand new couple generations old LG OLED, it's going to be around $1,500, right? So this TV lasted me 7 years. That's a good amount, and it's done. I think it should have lasted a few years longer, but, like, whatever. So I bought a TV, came the next day, I installed it. It's last year's LG C3 OLED, so it's like the mid-range 2023 OLED. I can say pretty confidently, as somebody who's, like, not a super, I understand that there have been 7 years of improvements here, or six generations of improvements. I didn't really see much of an improvement. Without really scrutinizing it, I calibrated it, I turned on a 4K movie, Dolby Vision, whatever, same thing. I was like, this looks pretty good, but so did my B7. And the fact that a 7-year newer television was not like, holy shit, this is insanely better right out of the box, is exactly why people are having a hard time getting excited about smartphones, because it's at that level now where Google is offering you 7 years of updates, confident that within 7 years, your phone should still feel relatively usable. And the fact that we still have people rocking like an iPhone 10 or iPhone 11.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And not batting an eye is also a testament to the fact that companies are now making phones that will last longer. Like your Pixel probably won't last 7 years because it's a Pixel. But we know anecdotally that Samsung phones and iPhones are lasting that long. And that's exactly the same reason as why I wasn't like, holy shit, this new OLED TV is night and day better than my 7-year-old version of the same thing.
Yeah. The only thing, I was basically cracking a joke, but like, it is a problem that like, these companies could at least try to solve by trying to be more experimental with their hardware. It's probably not what end users want. It's what you and I want, because like, it would be neat to see a company do some LG shit and fall on their face, but like do it in a fun way where we're like, yeah, you know, like you tried something, like nice job. But yes, like I think most people just want their phone to be an appliance that they upgrade every 4 or 5 years when it's, you know, the battery is lasting 3 hours a day and they're like, I guess I should upgrade this. And they unbox a new phone and they're like, yeah, the camera's better. That's cool. And then they don't think about it for another 5 years. Like, I think that's what most people want, which is...
But listen to what you're saying. You're like, in order to make... And I know it was a joke, but like, there's always truth in a joke, in that what you're saying is you need to completely change the form factor. You need to completely undermine the reason why regularly designed smartphones are popular in order to get people excited about them. And we did that with the foldable.
Foldables, yeah.
And it didn't really work.
No, it did. I mean, look, I still think people think foldables are neat. I had the Open when I was on my family vacation last month, and Maddie's family was like enjoying like trying it out and looking at it. They were like genuinely excited to see one. I don't think most of them had seen a foldable before, but that doesn't mean that like they're going to go out and buy one, because foldables are not made for most people. For one thing, they're too expensive. For another, they're too fragile and they're hard to protect. Like foldable cases are like bad because they're two pieces and they don't really protect the front very well. So yeah, like I don't think that's like the solve for like, outside of like true gadget nerds, or like I don't think most people would want one. But I don't know what anyone is looking for to make a smartphone more exciting. Like I and clearly Google and Samsung and Apple don't. I mean, there's the rumor this week that Apple's big reinvention of the iPhone will come next year with the iPhone 17. It will be a tier higher than the Pro Max, and the big thing will be that it's thinner, like the iPad Pro. That's the big new thing for them, is like, what if we made it thinner? Like I just think like all of these companies are out of ways to like draw people in to be like, you need the new iPhone, in a way that like Apple was able to do with like the iPhone 6, right? Or the iPhone 10. These new things of like, you won't believe what we did this
time. I don't think I need to remind anybody that Apple made the iPhone 13 thicker than the iPhone 12,
yeah,
because it wanted a bigger battery. Apple already went through this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know why they keep... Marquez Brownlee's video on the iPad Pro was like, yeah, super impressive that they made it this thin, and that like, it, at least in the 11-inch model, the battery is actually a little bit bigger. Imagine if they made it thicker and then the battery was even bigger. Wouldn't that be cool? Anyway, they didn't. They just made it thin so that it's impressive when you first pick it up and then you forget about it 30 minutes later. Like, I've never understood the quest towards 5-millimeter thick devices, but that's where we are.
I don't know. I think it's less about thinness than it is about weight, right? The thinner something is, the lighter it usually is.
And the iPad Pro is... The 11-inch one is, I think, like just about a pound, which is very light. It's lighter than the Air, which is
right.
Funny.
But the whole thing about that is you're probably putting it in a case. So the thinner and lighter it is, the lighter it is, the less impact a case will have, right? Because they made the right. Magic Keyboard even lighter this time as well. So yeah. Overall, you just have a much lighter laptop. I mean, when I got my MacBook Pro, not the new 14-inch one, but when I upgraded from a MacBook Air to like the old style MacBook Pro, even though it was maybe 500 grams heavier, it did feel significantly more cumbersome to travel with. And then when I upgraded to the 14-inch MacBook Pro, which is even heavier than that, I was like, okay, this is actually not super fun to travel with all the time. And I miss my Air. And now the fact that the Air and the Pro are so similar, except one is slightly thinner and lighter, I'm like, okay, I still get why lighter makes a big difference. With your phone, it's slightly different because it's smaller. It's a smaller absolute object. And yes, like if you're using your phone in bed, it's annoying to have a thicker, heavier phone. But with an iPad, I can absolutely understand the reason Apple wanted to go lighter. I think the current iPhone, Samsung, Pixel lineup is perfect, right? Like I see the balance there. I don't see Apple needing to make the iPhone thinner other than as an engineering marvel, which is also what the M4 iPad Pro is.
Well, and it's to your point about making it easier to carry, in my opinion, it's stupid because like the other rumor is that it will still be like gigantic. Like the screen will be huge, like close to 7 inches. So it's like not any more comfortable in my pocket because it's thinner. It's still huge. Like if you wanted to, and like they tried a small iPhone, it didn't sell, but it's still ridiculous that it's like, that doesn't make it any more, doesn't make a phone any more portable when it's 6.7, 8, 9 inches, right? Like it's still huge. So
yeah, maybe don't get the 13-inch iPad.
iPad Pro. Okay, this is, I mean, we're 7 tangents in, but I was like, you know, maybe I will upgrade. Like, I really want a mini, an iPad mini, but I was like, they're not going to make it it's just going to be a spec bump, and then it'll still be a bad screen and all expensive. So, like, maybe I'll upgrade my almost 4-year-old iPad Air to the 11-inch OLED Pro, the M4 Pro. I was like, let me go down this rabbit hole. I can get, like, $250 for this tablet, so it brings it down to a starting price of $750. I guess it didn't connect with me until I was, like, shopping for it, that I was like, oh, I'd also have to like get a new Apple Pencil and a new keyboard. Both of the things I have, because like I have an Apple Pencil. I got it for Christmas 1 year. I bought a refurbished Apple keyboard off of Woot for like half price because $300 is too expensive for those, but $150 was fine. And like, even though it's like roughly the same shape because it's just a little bit different, I'd have to replace both for like an extra like $500. And if I do this, I might just buy, like, Best Buy still has the M2 Pro, and, like, Apple might lose out on me upgrading to the OLED one because I'd have to replace all these accessories that, like, still work fine. I just don't get why they, like, I mean, it's the thinness is, like, part of the problem with the old keyboard case, but it's, like, I almost spent significantly more money on this, and I would have gone for a higher configuration. Like, I was going to drop probably $1,200 after trade-in on this iPad. I was thinking about it, and then like the second I realized I needed to replace accessories that work fine, I was like, oh, well, I'm not going to do that. Like that would be stupid. I won't do that now. And I don't know. Like I think that's such a swing and a miss that I didn't see mentioned in a lot of iPad reviews. We're way off track, but
it's okay. I don't want to talk more about the iPad because I there's still that part of me that wants one real bad, and every time I talk about it, I go to Apple.
The OLED one,
yeah,
it looks really cool, doesn't it?
It's so expensive here. It's like $1,400.
That's what I'm saying, though. Like they almost had me. They were like, I was like, you know, maybe I do need a what do they call the OLED? Tandem OLED. Maybe I do need tandem OLED.
You don't need
even though like OLED. I don't even use my iPad that much, but I'm like, I think I need tandem OLED. And then like the second it was like, oh, this isn't actually $1,200. This is $1,800. I'm like, oh, well, no, I'm not doing that. Like close the tab and never think about it again.
Lovely. Okay. I want to talk about the, so this Pixel 8a section that was supposed
fine,
to take
or buy it or
10
don't.
Minutes wasn't yeah. was like an hour. But yeah, buy it if you want. It's fine. Let's just move on. So I got a chance to try the Sonos Ace headphones. I went down to New York. I got a demo. I talked to the chief product officer. I talked to Giles Martin, son of George Martin, who produced all of the Beatles albums. Giles is a character. He's also the, I think he's the chief creative officer. I don't know exactly his title at Sonos, but all I know is that like when I go to a Sonos event, they really emphasize that they're an audio company and they care basically only about one thing, which is audio. So the big deal here is that Sonos is finally entering the headphone space and they're doing it right. And they're very open about the fact that the things that they didn't know how to do, they didn't just try to build them from scratch. They acquired or they licensed. And when I spoke to their executive team, they're like, yeah, we have been building things with our own tech for 20 years, but we also know that with headphones, it's really hard to just like figure it out. You can't compete with Sony and Bose and Apple with no experience and expect to meet them where they are, right? This is a very mature market. The Bluetooth headphone market is massive, but it's so saturated that you really have to like do it right from the first time. So I got to try the headphones. They're really nice. They're well-made. They're comfortable. The specs are all there. And they're like, yeah, we acquired this company called RHA. It was a small Scottish headphone maker and used their core tech to design the Sonos Ace. And I used to love RHA. I bought a lot of their headphones back when wired headphones were a thing. This was pre-Bluetooth. They sounded great. They were super comfortable, really, really well-made. But a small company, they would not have made much of an impact in the market. So Sonos was good to buy them. And then they were very clear that they partnered with Qualcomm on all the tech. So Qualcomm, the S5 chip is in here. They've got a bunch of Wi-Fi and Bluetooth solutions in here as well. It's pretty much like turnkey Qualcomm stuff for the tech. And that's great because we know that it's going to support aptX lossless and aptX adaptive for Android users. It's going to have really reliable Bluetooth. Battery life is good, et cetera. But hanging over this entire event was the fact that Sonos had just launched its app update 2 weeks earlier, and everybody freaking hated it. I brought this up with every interview I did. I did like three of them. And they're all like, oh yeah, like the people making a big deal about this on Reddit are the tiny, tiny percent of customers that use all these features that we left out of the initial update, right? Timers.
That's so funny for a company like Sonos to say, because those Reddit users who are mad is like, that is your demographic. Like Sonos, you have to like buy into Sonos. You have to be like kind of an audio, at least a little bit of a, you know, not an audiophile, but like, you have to really care about this stuff to like go deep into Sonos. And so to just like brush those people off is so like, you just don't get it.
Well, they don't get it. And they did an, I mean, Patrick Spence, the CEO, did an interview with Chris Welch at The Verge, who said that much, right? He's like, we should have communicated this better, but in a parallel universe where we had done that, we still would have launched the app without those features, right? We still would have.
Which I just don't get. Like, why? Like,
well, because they needed the new architecture to work with the Ace. So they had a deadline for the hardware. They knew the hardware was going to come in June, right? So they had to release the app before that. And I mean, I sort of understand that from a marketing perspective. And the engineers were probably just told, like, you have to crunch on this, get as much of it done, get the core aspects of the app finished. But the problem is that when the app launched, the core aspects were not finished and they didn't work at all. It wasn't that you couldn't, there weren't sleep timers or alarms anymore. It was that you couldn't group speakers reliably anymore. You couldn't play the next song in a queue. Like, it was just like core functionality was missing. Plus, if you were a Sonos user that had multiple speakers, you were just getting errors all the time. They did a hot fix a few days after the initial app launch, which fixed a bunch of those errors. But for like 3 days, I could not group speakers in my home, period. Like, they just would not group. So that's launching an app with core functionality removed. And nobody wants to acknowledge that they should have done the thing that a lot of other companies do when they launch a massive app overhaul: maintain access to the old code base. Like, just give rebrand the old app as Sonos Classic. Let it live out there for six months. It's not going to work with the Ace. That's fine.
Exactly. It's have it out there and be like, look, if you're buying the Ace, you need to switch to this. We're going to migrate everybody in 6 months. But if you're not buying the Ace, you can still use this while we finish work on the app. And also launch the app with the Ace so that it's obvious why you're doing this rather than a few weeks ahead of time where people are like, so you just like screwed everything up just because you wanted to ship this app now for some reason. Like, just a total like misfire.
Well, the other part that really vexes me is that Sonos went through this when they transitioned from S1 to S2. Like, they've done this before, right? They didn't overhaul the app, but they overhauled the infrastructure powering the app. And they gave people a pretty long deadline before their stuff stopped working. And a lot of people weren't super happy with it because, like, it removed support for some of the really old speakers, the ones that were like 2013 and before. But there was a pretty good runway where Sonos was like, yeah, if you want to upgrade, you have to upgrade your speakers. We're going to give you a lot of time. We're going to support you. You can still use the S1 app. It's still available on the App Store if you want to download it. This was like, nope, we're done. See ya. So since then, they've started re-adding some of those old features. Most notably, they added back a lot of the accessibility features, the talkover or voiceover features that were absent from the beginning, which meant people with vision problems couldn't use the app at all. So those are back, and they have a timeline for re-adding all of the pro user, power user features by mid-June. In the meantime, I can't talk about the Ace performance yet because I'm under embargo, but I will say, if you're sort of comparing a bunch of $399, $449, $499 headphones together, these ones stack up pretty well. So they've got good ANC from what I heard at the demo. They have 30 hours of battery life. They're very comfortable. They have removable magnetic ear pads. They, as I said, have like full Qualcomm support. So Android, iOS users can use them at high quality codecs. Although I think iPhone users are still limited to AAC. I don't think they support what's Apple's one? AADC or something. Anyway, Apple has its own lossless codec that the AirPods Max supports. ALAC, Apple lossless audio codec. So all that is like very straightforward, right? These are good quality Bluetooth headphones. They don't have any gesture stuff. This is all very much like, if you want to use this, there are tactile buttons, and they said that they spent years with different designs, and I believe them because Sonos is very good about design. And I really like the fact that it's called the content button. It swipes up and down for volume, and then you press it in to play and pause, and then you hold it to switch to what they call TV swap. And this is where the Sonos integration comes in, which I think is interesting here. So if you have a Sonos soundbar, you can swap the audio with the headphones. So you pair it with a single soundbar, and you basically get head tracking, you get Dolby Atmos spatial audio, and they do a calibration of the room you're in so that there's really a seamless handover between the audio from the soundbar and the headphones. And I did a bunch of demos on this with movies, music, everything, and it sounds really good. And I can see myself using this in many circumstances, like my wife falls asleep on the couch, I want to watch a movie that's not at like one volume, I put on the headphones. The problem is that my headphones are probably upstairs in my office, or they're in my bag, or they're probably not where I want them to be in that moment. And I'm at 10 p.m., I'm too lazy to go upstairs and get them, right? And like, I asked them, like, what do you think about this, right? People are using their headphones or throwing them on a table, they're upstairs in their office, they're in a bag. They're like, oh, just, you know, we'd like you to buy two pairs of Ace headphones. And I'm like, no, that's the wrong answer. Oh, I hate this answer. But I get it. There's this value add that they really want to show off. And there's a lot of people that have Sonos soundbars, and this is just a value add on top of that. Conversely, it's very weird that there's no Wi-Fi support for just listening to audio, right?
I've been waiting to ask you about the Wi-Fi stuff and the group stuff, really, because it feels like the reason to buy Sonos headphones would be that it works with the ecosystem the way other Sonos products does. And it sounds like these, like, they do with the soundbar, right?
Correct.
And it's only working with the Arc at launch. It's the other soundbars are coming later. But it doesn't have all of these other Sonos-y things. And it seems like if you're going to ask $450 for it, that's a bit of a miss.
So here's what Sonos tells me. They experimented with Wi-Fi and like Qualcomm itself launched a Wi-Fi supported hybrid audio platform so that eventually you'll be able to connect your headphones to your Wi-Fi and stream in-house at a much lower, higher quality, but also lower power profile. And the fact that the Ace don't do this or doesn't do, I don't know, singular, plural, is on purpose. What they told me is that regular users don't want to start listening to a song on Wi-Fi, walk out the house, and have their song stop working because you're streaming from the internet over your router versus streaming a song from your phone connected to Bluetooth. So that disparity in expectations is exactly why these don't work over Wi-Fi. When you pair it with your soundbar, there is a point-to-point Wi-Fi connection, which is how they support Atmos and full spatial audio because the bandwidth is much larger. But there's no way to connect these to your Sonos system over Wi-Fi, which brings up another major issue that I have. Years ago, Sonos launched Sonos Radio, which is their kind of version of streaming radio. I listen to this almost every day. Like, it is one of the unspoken reasons to buy a Sonos speaker or set up a set of speakers because their channels are awesome. Their radio stations are beautifully curated. They always have really cool, interesting music. They've got some great kind of like hosted radio shows by people like Tom York, FKA Twigs, a bunch of other people that I really admire.
Well, I didn't know about the Tom York show. Now I need to sign up.
So guess what? Because you can only stream Sonos Radio to a speaker, and because it's only streaming over Wi-Fi, there's no way to stream Sonos Radio to the headphones, period. You cannot stream Sonos Radio over Bluetooth at all. They've never allowed you to open the Sonos app and have any pair of headphones to stream over Bluetooth. They've never supported that. And I was like, okay, when they launch a pair of headphones, they have to allow Sonos Radio outside the confines of their speakers over Wi-Fi. Like, they have to. This is, Sonos got into the content game, right? They want you to upgrade to Sonos Radio HD for $8 a month and like do the thing that every other streaming service is asking you to do. And yet, this was not a launch proposition. And I'm like, this is so strange to me that it's being treated like an also-ran. So yeah, I mean, this is an interesting product. It's $450. And then out of the box, I'm like, okay, I also asked the team, like, you're getting into a market that is already saturated. Is your expectation that the small number of Sonos users are going to go out and buy a Sonos Ace headphone, even though most of them, many of them probably already have something from Sony or Bose or Apple or Audio Technica or Master and Dynamic or any number of audiophile brands that also make Bluetooth headphones? Or are you trying to get more people to buy Sonos speakers by building a really great headphone? And they're like, yes. Like, obviously that's going to be their answer. They're like, yes, both. But the truth is that I think it's going to be very difficult, even as recognizable as Sonos's brand is, and they're very much synonymous with like high quality, I think they're going to have a really hard time in this market.
Well, to go back to something you said a couple minutes ago, their concern over regular users don't want to walk out of their house and have their audio stop working because they were listening to it over Wi-Fi. Regular people are not buying $450 headphones. They're buying $99 AirPods on sale on Black Friday. Like, if they want to go mainstream, that's fine. But like, the high entry price to get into the Sonos ecosystem and then to continue building out your Sonos ecosystem means that you have a customer that is aware of this stuff, right? They are aware they are listening over Wi-Fi because they've spent $4,000 on your products and they've done their research and they know how this thing works, because they wouldn't spend $4,000 on something they didn't know how it works, like most people, right? Unless they were gifted it or something. And I just feel like it's such a miss to like not build this into the ecosystem when that's like your whole thing, is that everything works together seamlessly. And the idea that like Sonos users, the same people who are like yelling at you about your new app, would not be able to intelligently be aware of the fact that in their house they're listening over Wi-Fi and they might need to like switch something in the app or briefly disconnect to switch back to Bluetooth when they're leaving for work in the morning. Like, I just don't buy that. It seems like a really deep misunderstanding of their user base in a way that like really surprises me.
Yes, agreed. And my suspicion is that the Qualcomm solution that allows the ability to stream music over Wi-Fi is not ready. And that they probably had either this point-to-point Wi-Fi solution between the headphone and the soundbar is some alternative chip that is not the thing that allows you to connect your headphones to a router. And that's why they didn't allow this. And my suspicion is that the next generation of Ace, which will release in 2026 or so, will allow that. And they will go back on that and say, we've invented Wi-Fi headphones, blah, blah, blah.
But then why, like, no one should buy these? Because it's so obvious that that will be fixed in a second generation update to these, that like no Sonos fan should buy these $450 headphones, because they're going to be pissed off in 2 years when the ones that they actually wanted are now on sale for $500 or whatever.
Well, I think that they are very confident that these are tier one headphones that can compete.
I'm sure they are.
Day one with any other products out there.
Yeah, but separate of the Sonos ecosystem. Like, this would be, it's almost more targeted towards someone like me who doesn't own a Sonos product and would just want like good headphones.
Agreed. The other thing that kind of gets to me is like, I know that I buy my high-end headphones like once every 5 years or so on Black Friday or Prime Day or whenever. And like Bose and Sony, they always have an MSRP of whatever, right? $499, $450. And I always buy them for $100 less because they do go on sale. Sonos products never go on sale, almost never, right? Because they're that same company like Apple that values their products at a specific number, and they rarely put their products on sale. These will be $449 basically the entire year. And the only headphones that are more expensive are the AirPods Max. And that's okay for Apple because they don't need to sell these in super high quantities. It's just an interesting decision, right? And I agree that $399 is probably too cheap and $499 is probably too expensive and this is a sweet spot, but I do worry that this is not going to... I like this product and I look forward to reviewing them and really like putting them through their paces and comparing them to other high-end headphones. But I'm very concerned that they're not good enough for what they're charging. All right, so that's the Sonos Ace. I will have a review in the next few days, weeks, months, I can't say. The weird thing is that when Sonos lost the lawsuit to Google last year, they restored the ability to change your media volume for casting on non-Pixel phones pretty quickly. Now with Android 15 Beta 2, you can now change your media volume for casting once again on your Pixel. So that's nice.
Kind of a fun side story.
Yeah, and Sonos stuff. Yeah. Sonos is indirectly responsible for that. Okay, let's go through these AI announcements as quickly as we can. This week, Microsoft and Qualcomm and a bunch of OEM partners launched the Copilot Plus platform alongside Qualcomm's X Elite and X Plus chips, which were announced earlier this year, but they are coming to laptops from Dell, from HP, Lenovo, others, Acer, Asus, and Microsoft itself launched a new Surface laptop in a brand new design, as well as a Surface Pro 11, which is an identical design, but with the new chip. it also updated a bunch of Windows stuff. So they announced partnerships with Adobe and a bunch of other companies to optimize their apps for ARM, Windows on ARM. And there's this thing called Recall, which is basically relying on an MPU, which is part of the X platform from Snapdragon. And there's also a minimum spec. So any Copilot Plus PC has to have at least 16 gigs of RAM and 256 gigs of storage. So this is a really coordinated event. They were very secret about it. Microsoft was extremely secret about it. And apparently the X Elite and X Plus are extremely high performing for what they are, similar to the M series. They offer great battery life, et cetera, et cetera. It is wild to me how many products are being announced that support this on day one.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much every major Windows laptop brand had a thing to show, like a laptop to show off.
Yeah, exactly. And like HP used this as the opportunity to like rebrand its entire laptop line back to Omnibook.
Yep.
Which is hilarious because like Spectre is just a way better brand, but whatever.
It is, yeah.
So you were talking about Recall earlier.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear your take on this whole Copilot Plus initiative and Recall in general.
I mean, Recall is the one that like I think got all the attention. It got my attention more than anything else. And it says so much to me. I mean, this is my entire take, and it's probably not even a good take. It says so much to me, and they'd have to find a way to do this or whatever, blah, 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 that they're like, Recall will definitely take screenshots of your passwords and your banking information and everything. It has no way to detect that you're doing it. But don't worry, it will not screenshot Disney Plus. We made sure that DRM content is protected. Don't worry about it. And I understand that like it can't tell what a text field is, blah, blah, blah. I get it. It is just so funny to me. They're like, we're shipping this thing on Copilot computers. It's going to just constantly take screenshots of what you're looking at. But we are looking out for our favorite brands, Disney, Warner Brothers. We got you guys. Don't worry about it. Netflix, all good. That's all. I don't even know if it's a good take. I just like, I think it's so funny of like, it's such a like distillation of like who AI is for. I feel like, I don't know. This feature's insane. Like it's cool in theory, I guess, but I also like, I think I would turn it off. I think like whatever utility I would get from it, it's on device. I don't care if I had a Copilot PC, and I probably will someday because they're so dedicated to this idea that I think I would turn it off. Just out of like, I don't want something constantly taking screenshots of what I'm looking at on my computer. Like, that's just a gut feeling I have. No matter how much utility you get from it, I feel weird about.
Yeah, I think the fact that people sued, there's a class action lawsuit against Google because they misadvertised or poorly advertised what incognito mode does on your Chrome browser.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, the fact that this exists. And Microsoft is like, no, we promise. We promise. It's just weird. It's weird to me that I get it, right? There's that idea of like infinite memory, the Black Mirror episode that you kind of can go back at any time and look at your memories. You were spending so long on your computer every day, you might as well be able to go back and look and see what you were doing 5 days ago, whatever. I think this is, it's pretty freaky deaky to me.
Look, we have all been there. We have all been like, oh, God damn it. Like a few days ago, I was looking at a thing. I don't remember what it was. I can't find it in my browser history. I have no way of remembering what that product or what that website, what like, God, I wish I could just like, Recall would probably help you with that. I just don't know if like being generous once a month that I run into that is worth knowing that just my computer's just constantly being like, nice bank account balance. Like, what are we looking at today? Like, I just don't like it. And if AI is as powerful as all of these companies want it to be, I feel like they could have taken their time with it and like figured out a way for Recall to at least try to automatically tell when you're looking at a bank account or like other like information that should be kept confidential to be like, we're not going to screen, like these are automatically deleted, or like the feature turns off when we detect that, like, or when we think you're looking at a bank account. Like, it's another example of these features just not feeling like they're actually made for consumers. And speaking of which, AI overview. That's my pivot.
You want some glue with your pizza?
I do. That sounds great. Hey, Daniel, here's the problem when you train your LLM on Reddit. A lot of jokes on Reddit.
A lot of jokes.
A lot of shit posting on Reddit. And it turns out that maybe LLMs can't tell the difference between shit posts and genuine answers to questions. I think that's what we've learned this week.
Yeah, and then Google comes out and says that it's only on a small number of SERPs or a small number of searches that it's making these errors on. But even if it's small, like there was an example that it's pretty disgusting, actually.
Yeah.
That was posted on Twitter. I mean, I don't know if this is real, and I hope it's not real. I don't have access to AI Overview, but somebody wrote, "I'm feeling depressed," and you would hope that it would pull information from respected sources about mental health and suicide prevention and depression. But the AI Overview in this case said there are many things to help to deal with your depression.
Editor's note, we've omitted the example that was provided. If you're affected by what we're talking about, there are resources available to you. In North America, you can call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. We've also provided a link to International Mental Health and Emergency Services in the show notes.
Again, there are many examples of this, and I hope this is not real. Or if it's real, it's gone by now.
Yeah.
I really hope so.
Well, they've been taking them down as they've been going viral on
exactly.
On
and
Twitter.
Google has always done that with low-quality SERPs. But the fact that this is even... that we are unsure as to whether or not it's real speaks to the fact that Google rolling out AI overviews to everyone in the US is probably more dangerous than it needs to be, while also undermining the publishing business. Because if it's showing a Reddit suggestion before anything else, Google has its priorities in the wrong place. Right.
Yeah. I, in my AI overview, and I have said this for over a year now, since the first time I tried it out when it was SGE, it either plagiarizes or hallucinates with very little in between. Like it is one of those two routes. It is either just stealing content from somewhere else on the internet and then maybe rewriting it. Like sometimes not, but maybe it's rewriting it. Or it is just making stuff up, or it's more recently now stealing from Reddit. I mean, look, I tweeted this yesterday. For every insane lunatic example, as you just like the one you just pointed out, or the glue in pizza thing, or whatever, right? For all of those, there's 10 much smaller, less insane examples where you're like, what does that even mean? And then you find out it's just... So yesterday I was editing a feature from a freelancer, and the freelancer used the term napkin math. And I was like, is that correct? Is it back of napkin math? So I look up napkin math to make sure that that's the right phrase to use. And it's that, or it's back of the envelope, all that there's, but it's a good enough term. AI overview gives me a definition for it, right? Gives me a whole thing, gives me links to dictionaries and Wikipedia, et cetera. Gives me some stuff. And then at the bottom, it says, and I screenshotted this, one way to practice napkin math is to work on your own problems. Another way is to subscribe to a newsletter that provides a problem to practice on every few weeks. And I said, what does that mean? What is it trying to talk about here? Why is it telling me to subscribe to a newsletter to practice a problem every few weeks? And the answer, as I found out by searching that phrase, is that there's some GitHub project that is called napkin math to practice coding, I think. And it had a newsletter that would send you a project to practice on every few weeks.
This
and
is the internet
from that.
The thing that keeps coming back to me here is that the internet is messy.
Yes.
And by giving you a definitive statement of something before it gives you the 10 blue links.
Yeah.
I mean, we live in the world where we want our site to rank higher than your site. That's just the internet. It's always been that way on Google. Google built this relationship with publishers and with what one would hope are high value sources of information, right? And is now completely undermining that by giving you one definitive answer that it hopes is not a hallucination. And it's just math that if you, it's almost like that idea of you want to be the first result on Google, but there's also 3, 4, 5, 100 results underneath it that you can check. And most of the time people will click on one of the top three links. Most of the time it's the top link, but there are other options here. And by cordoning off AI overview and separating out and it being the first thing that you see, even if the 10 blue links are still underneath it, what are the chances that people are going to go below it and click on those links? Number one becomes number five in importance. And we'll see that bear out over the next few years as these AI overview results end up normalizing. And even as hallucinations dwindle and Google gets better, which it will, obviously, the fact is...
I'm not sold on that. I think this will be a problem forever.
I mean, I hope not, but you're probably right. I just... That part to me is the thing that really scares me more than the actual hallucinations. It's that we have been training everybody to think critically about the results on Google for 20 years. And we're no longer encouraging that scrutiny. Where Google is telling us, no, trust us. We're going to do the sourcing. I mean, obviously, we've been trusting Google to apply an opaque algorithm to rank things, and we don't know how that algorithm works. And when it impacts us negatively, which if you've been following the internet over the last 6 months, like it's hit everybody negatively. Android Police has been hit extremely badly over the last few months. And Google's not coming out and saying this is why, but it feels like there has to be some sort of correlation. Yeah, you did.
I have my feelings about this as a writer, as a person who makes things online, right? Like, even setting those aside, even as an end user, I think this is a huge misfire. The fact that, like, my Twitter feed is filled with people dunking on this thing, right? Like, normal people, not, like, our normal tech community people, but, like, normal people going viral because of screenshots. Like, search is Google's business, and, like, they have called this the next chapter of search, right? Like, this is the future of their core business. I mean, advertising, but whatever. They're saying they're going to put ads in AI overview soon anyway. So, like, this is the core business, and everyone is laughing at it and coming up with ways to get around it and being like, use this, like, search filter, use this, like, URL hack. Like, that's bad. All of this feels bad from, like, Google's perspective, which is why I'm so surprised that, like, as we talked about, the share price keeps going up, because, like, people are, like, pointing at the main thing Google does and being like, this is not just bad, we've been talking about how it's been bad for, like, a couple years now, it's, like, unusable and, like, a laughing stock. And I don't even know how, like, AI overview recovers from this first 2 weeks of everybody in the US using it and being like, this sucks. Like, this is embarrassingly bad. Like, this is fully anecdotal, but, like, I swear to God, I'm getting less AI overview results than I was a week ago. I was getting them on almost every search a week ago, and now I'm getting them, like, one every, like, eight. I swear they've dialed it down. And I wouldn't be surprised if, like, there's a moment where it's like, why am I only, I'm only getting it, like, one every, like, 80 searches when I use, like, very specific phrasing in a search. Like, I think they're, like, secretly dialing this back because they know it's bad. They know that this is, like, too early, and, like, maybe we'll never be ready in a way that, like, doesn't break search. But, like, at the same time, I get that they feel they have to do it because OpenAI is over there and, like, constantly, like, rumored to be launching a search engine and all that stuff. And I just, like, it really feels like they are stuck in between, like, a rock and a hard place of, like, what do you do? You can't not do it, but also when you do it, it's, like, broken in a way that, like, normal people notice. Like, not just us, but, like, normal people. I don't know. Like, it's bad, but it's a problem that I don't know if there's an easy solution to.
Yeah, at this point, it doesn't seem like they're gonna, or they can, unwind any of this, right? They're refactoring the whole company, the whole industry, to push it forward.
I mean, and the only thing they could do is make it go back to making it opt-in. But like, even then, I think like that would be bad because I think most people would not turn it on or not know to turn it on. I guess you could make it so that you always have to click the button to generate a response, but then like, I don't know.
One, like the thing that keeps coming back to me is like Google search as a product is also not what it used to be, you know? So it's not like going back to just the 10 blue links is going to fix the broken internet. It's not. And like, that's what I keep thinking about is when this ends up at its eventual maintenance point where they roll this out and it's just like in maintenance mode, always updating behind the scenes, kind of like Google search has been for the last 20 years. And they release regular, whatever they're called, core updates to AI. They, you know, they update their various LLMs and they integrate them into search. What does that look like in 5 years when we're not talking about this product every day as an AI product? It's just Google search. Will we still have a job? I don't know. Nilay Patel of The Verge keeps talking about Google Zero and how every publisher is eventually just going to hit Google Zero. That terrifies me. It terrifies me.
That interview too, like, Sundar Pichai, just I his answers were, in my opinion, terrible. Like like I'm not saying like, oh, I felt bad about them. I'm saying like felt unprepared to deal with this line of questioning about like where this company is going. And his examples, he used it like three times, this analogy of restaurants, of, oh, well, like maybe traffic is dropping because like people are going to a different site the way they go to a different restaurant. Like, that's not how the internet works. Like, you don't get full from reading one article. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, it's truly like, I don't know what is going on with this company's priorities is what I would say. Like, I truly don't know where they're trying to lead. And yeah, like the idea of Google Zero, I think is very real in a way that like, it doesn't feel like Google is willing to admit.
Well, let's see. I don't know if we'll find the answer today, but I do want to just talk quickly about a couple other small AI related things. So Humane, the company that famously put out a very successful hardware product earlier this year,
replaced my phone. It did.
Celebrating that launch by looking for a buyer. Apparently they are valuing themselves between $750 and $1 billion. And yes. $750 million.
That's also how much I value myself at. In case you're
it could be $750 to $1 billion. It's, you know, it's a pretty big delta there, but who cares?
Yeah.
And they did raise $230 million.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I don't know if it will sell, but hopefully they can get some satisfaction. And then this week, OpenAI was back in the news because Sam Altman stepped in it a little bit. Why don't you talk about the Scarlett Johansson gate? And then we'll end the show there.
So right before I/O, when I was on a plane headed there, OpenAI had their big ChatGPT 4.0. It's pronounced 4.0, right? I actually don't.
Yeah. Know. Oh, Omni.
Yeah, 4.0 announcement, and part of it was this voice assistant, this like very natural sounding voice assistant, and everyone went, "Wow, it's just like her. It sounds exactly like her." And Sam Altman tweeted her. And it turns out that it sounds like her because that was the point. They had reached out to Scarlett Johansson last fall to be like, would you like to voice an assistant for us? And she said, no. And they said, okay. And then they designed a voice tool that sounds... So I don't think... Because I've seen some people being like, I don't hear it at all. I think Sky, which is the name of the voice assistant that OpenAI demoed, doesn't sound so much exactly like Scarlett Johansson's voice as much as it's the like vocal delivery sounds exactly how Scarlett Johansson's performance in her sounds to me. That's where it comes from, is like the tone is identical when you watch clips from that movie back to back with like the demo.
Okay, stop walking this direction. It's the other way. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, the tunnel on the left is the only one we haven't tried.
Byte was a curious robot, always exploring.
I started this story, but I want a little bit more emotion in your voice, a little bit more drama.
Got it. Let's add some drama. Once upon a time, in a world not too different from ours, there was a robot named Byte.
No, ChatGPT, I really want maximal emotion, like maximal expressiveness, much more than you were doing before.
Understood. Let's amplify the drama. Once upon a time, in a world not too different from ours.
And yeah, so like they had, like right before the demo, reached out to her like one more time, presumably knowing that they were about to show this thing that sounds like her. And now she's very upset about it and has lawyered up and might sue OpenAI. It's pretty much where we are right now. I don't think she has sued them yet, but I know The Verge ran a piece with like some legal analysis of lawyers being like, she's got a case. Like there are, especially in California, like there are previous examples of like companies hiring soundalikes and getting sued over it, and the actors, the performers that are suing, being successful in their lawsuit. So I don't know where this goes, but the statement that Scarlett Johansson put out is fairly damning. And it's not like she hasn't lawyered up and sued big companies before. She did it with Disney a couple of years ago and she won. So
honestly, just the self-owns from these AI companies, just they continue coming. So that's where we are. That's the state of the internet in 2024. Things are going great. Keep enjoying your free content, please.
Yeah. Visit. Just to recap, all new gadgets are bad. All the AI software is bad.
But the websites are good. Go to the websites. That's the lasting hope for the internet.
Go watch Jenny Nicholson's 4-hour Star Wars video. I had a great time doing that last weekend. The internet is abuzz with Star Wars hotel takes. That's my positive recommendation for people. Great video.
I'll also put out a video recommendation. James Hoffman, who's famously a fan of coffee, put out a video that I thought would be pretty underwhelming. It's called "What Does a Great Cup of Coffee Taste Like?" which is really hard. If you are not a huge coffee snob like I am, it's really hard to describe. And that's not what he did, sort of. He made a 6-minute one take video. So technically this video is masterful, but it's also just a really fun video to watch. And then there's a fantastic behind the scenes of the same video. So that's what you should do. You should go watch a 4-hour Star Wars video and then go watch a 10-minute or 15 minutes of coffee. And then you can enjoy your weekend.
I have pulled this up. I'm going to watch it after we finish recording. But I also just want to say, I asked Gemini what a great cup of coffee tastes like. And it said that unlike music, there's no single correct taste, which is a weird thing to say because there's also no single correct taste for music. And then at the end of it, it said you can also watch James Hoffman's video on what does a great cup of coffee taste like for a more detailed explanation.
Incredible. Time is a flat circle. Thanks, Gemini. It really is. All right. That's it. Will, I hope you feel better.
Yeah, long weekend, Memorial Day weekend. So I'm headed your way tomorrow. I'm headed to the cottage. So,
well, wave on the way by.
I will off the 407. I will.
All right. Well, enjoy it. I hope you feel better. The beautiful air clears up your lungs, and I hope everybody has a great week. And we'll talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
What does a great cup of coffee taste like? Sadness.